Good afternoon and welcome to Outlook Live. I'm Amy Bone with the Federal Reserve and I'll be your facilitator. Today we'll cover interagency overdraft services consumer compliance discussion. This call is scheduled for 90 minutes. Let me start with a big thank you to our presenters who we'll be hearing from in just a moment, but first let's jump to slide 2 and cover some logistics for today's call. If you haven't done so yet, click on the webinar link you received after registering, or you can head over to our website at www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. There you can find the session materials and eventually the archive of this call. And just a quick note on the webinar. We encourage you to listen to the audio through your PC, but if you need a phone option, we do have a limited number available, so just let us know. As for questions, please submit them by clicking on the Ask Question button in the webinar. I'd also like to remind you that we are offering continuing professional education credits for attending the session today. If you're interested in that, you must do two things. First, be registered for the session, and second, you must complete the post-session survey, which I will send out after the call. And let me cover the quick legal disclaimer. The opinions expressed in this presentation are intended for informational purposes and are not formal opinions of nor binding on the Federal Reserve System or Board of Governors or any other agency. With all that said, we're ready to get started, and I'll turn it over to Ducey Lay from the Federal Reserve Board of Governors.
Great. Thank you, Amy. My name is Ducey Lay, and I am the Managing Counsel here at the Federal Reserve Board. I'd like to welcome all of you to today's webinar on overdrafts. The purpose of this webinar is to discuss past overdraft practices and issues that were identified through consumer complaints, examinations, and enforcement actions, and is not intended to preview any forward-looking activities of the agencies with respect to overdrafts. So for today's discussion, I'm joined by colleagues from 4 federal regulatory agencies, in addition to the Federal Reserve. Moving on to slide 3, in speaking order, we have from the OCC, Kimberly Hebb, Director of Compliance Training and Tools. From the NCUA, Lisa Robertson, Program Officer in the Division of Consumer Compliance, Policy and Outreach. For the Federal Reserve, I'll be speaking. I'm Ducey Lay, Managing Counsel of the UDAP Enforcement Section. From the CFPB, Victoria Pawelski, Counsel, Supervision Policy from Supervision, Enforcement, and Fair Lending. And for the FDIC, Artie Hollyfield, Senior Policy Analyst in the Division of Depositor and Consumer Protection. So we are each speaking for ourselves. Any opinions or views stated by us, the presenters, are our own and may not represent the views of each of our respective agencies. Furthermore, the presentation of each presenter does not constitute legal interpretation, guidance, or advice of any of the agencies. We also note that while the agencies on this webinar may have identified similar overdraft practices and issues, each agency may have arrived at different findings and conclusions based on the very specific facts and circumstances of the particular case before them. So with that, I'd like to turn over the presentation to Kimberly from the OCC.
Thanks, Ducey, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this interagency webinar and share agency observations and some best practices. As Ducey noted, I was recently selected as the Director for Compliance Training and Tools within the Compliance Risk Division of the OCC's Consumer and Community Affairs Department. Within Compliance Risk, we direct the development of compliance supervision policy and examination procedures, provide policy interpretation and guidance to the field staff, and represent the OCC on interagency task forces and working groups. In my new role as the Director for Compliance Training and Tools, I will be focused on the development of examiner training and industry training, including formal classroom and webinars like this, risk identification, analysis, and examination tools and aids for consumer protection, CRA, fair lending, and BSA AML areas. In my brief time today, I plan to focus on communications with consumers. I'll go over some rules and guidance that apply to communications with consumers about overdraft programs, give a couple of examples of issues that we've seen, and conclude with a few observations on risk management practices. But first, I thought it might be helpful to set the stage for the OCC's role when it comes to ensuring that national banks and federal savings associations comply with laws and regulations that apply to overdraft practices. I'm going to be referring to the institutions that the OCC regulates as banks in my presentation. For banks with total assets of $10 billion or less, the OCC has supervisory and enforcement authority for federal consumer financial laws. The list of federal consumer financial laws includes the Electronic Fund Transfer Act and the Truth in Savings Act, which I'll discuss in a moment. The CFPB has supervisory and enforcement authority for these laws for banks with total assets of more than $10 billion. However, supervision for compliance with Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, or FTC Act, which I'll also talk about in a moment, remains with the OCC for banks regardless of asset size. This is because the term federal consumer financial law does not include some laws that apply to banks in the consumer protection area, like the FTC Act. On slide 5, there's a list of primary laws, rules, and supervisory guidance documents that the OCC looks to in evaluating banks' overdraft programs. The first regulation listed is Regulation E. Regulation E implements the Electronic Funds Transfer Act. As it relates to our topic today, Regulation E covers affirmative consent and disclosure requirements that must be followed before a financial institution may charge a fee for covering an overdraft that results from either an ATM or one-time debit card transaction. You'll be hearing more detail on Regulation E from our next presenter. The next regulation is Regulation DD, implementing the Truth in Savings Act. Regulation DD covers disclosures for deposit accounts. For the purposes of overdraft fees, Regulation DD requires account disclosures before account opening and also on periodic statements. This regulation also covers required terms for certain advertisements promoting the payment of overdrafts. Next on the slide is the FTC Act, which prohibits unfair or deceptive acts or practices. Later in the presentation, Victoria Pulowski from the CFPB will be discussing the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act prohibition on unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices. And even if a bank's overdraft program complies with the requirements of the regulations, it can still run afoul of the FTC Act if the program or marketing materials are unfair or deceptive. Moving on to supervisory guidance, the agencies provided joint guidance in 2005, when automated overdraft programs had just then recently become more prevalent. This guidance covers both safety and soundness as well as compliance issues. While it predates the amendments to Regulation E, it still provides helpful insight into framing clear and balanced communications with consumers. For instance, best practices include refraining from encouraging routine or intentional overdrafts, fairly representing the consequences of extensive use of overdrafts as well as alternatives, training staff to accurately explain the overdraft program and alternatives, making sure not to suggest that the overdraft program is free, and clearly disclosing fees and that multiple fees will be charged in a single day if applicable. A second OCC guidance document, Bulletin 2010-15, deals with communications about opting into overdraft protection programs. It reminds banks that marketing around opting in must not be unfair or deceptive and should provide timely, clear, accurate, and balanced information that will promote informed decision making. Finally, on this slide is Bulletin 2013-29. Which gives comprehensive guidance on managing the risks of third-party relationships. This guidance could be relevant in the overdraft context in areas such as transaction processing or telemarketing. Next, I'd like to talk about two scenarios. Scenario one is on slide 6. In this fact pattern, the bank's deposit account disclosures stated the bank would subtract deposited funds that were not yet available from the ledger balance to obtain the adjusted balance used to make overdraft fee decisions. In actuality, the bank also subtracted funds for must-pay items or items that had been authorized but not yet presented to the bank from the ledger balance to determine whether there were sufficient funds. If funds were insufficient after this additional subtraction, the bank imposed a fee. This disconnect between the bank's disclosures and actual practices for making fee decisions resulted in a finding of deception under the FTC Act and consent orders requiring restitution and the payment of a civil money penalty. Making sure customers understand how fees are imposed is, of course, important to assist them in avoiding overdrafts and fees. Many customers with low balances are very diligent about checking their balances, but if they don't understand how the fees are imposed, it makes it difficult or impossible for them to adjust their transactions and behavior to avoid overdrafting. Scenario 2 is on slide 7. And here, the bank promoted its deposit products in a brochure that highlighted the free or low-cost features of accounts, but omitted information about costly features of the account, such as an overdraft protection. The brochure suggested that certain accounts were well-suited for customers who had previous difficulty managing their bank accounts, and again, while omitting information about the costs of overdraft protection. The OCC found the brochure deceptive because it omitted information about high-cost features of the accounts, such as the overdraft protection. This scenario highlights the importance of fair and balanced information on the costs of an overdraft protection program. As everyone on this call appreciates, overdrafts can be very expensive for some consumers. These consumers can quickly find themselves with negative account balances that they are unable to bring positive. Marketing of overdraft services that minimizes or fails to mention fees and costs and concentrates only on benefits, especially when targeted to consumers likely to be frequent overdrafters, exposes institutions to risk under the FTC Act. On slide 8, I'll wrap up quickly by reviewing some risk management practices that can help address some of the issues and problems we've seen. First, the bank itself needs to understand how fee decisions are made so that it can ensure that its practices are accurately described to consumers. If vendors provide processing services, the bank needs to understand those processes. This includes how, when, and why, and what options the bank has to tailor the product or process. If the bank's systems change as a result of events such as mergers, a change in vendor, or adoption of new software or updates to current software or systems, the bank needs to review its communications with consumers to make sure they are still accurate. Next, listen to customers. In our experience, many customers are not shy about speaking up when they think an overdraft fee has been imposed unfairly. We've even seen customer complaints that were specific provisions of Regulation E were cited. Tracking and reviewing complaints and then escalating issues that could indicate systemic problems to senior management can help the bank quickly address problems. Finally, other data can be used to help the bank proactively manage risks. For instance, an opt-in rate for transactions covered under Regulation E that is significantly out of line with industry averages could indicate that customers don't understand their options or that account opening personnel are using inappropriate account opening tactics. And data on the percentage of customers incurring high fee amounts, negative account balances, and account closures due to overdrafts can provide important information to help the bank manage risk. With that, I'll turn the call over to Lisa Robertson from the NCUA.
Thank you, Kimberly. Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Robertson, and I'm a program officer in the Division of Consumer Compliance, Policy, and Outreach in the Office of Consumer Financial Protection and Access at the National Credit Union Administration. NCUA is an independent agency of the government that is responsible for regulating, chartering, and supervising federal credit unions. NCUA also operates and manages the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund, which insures accounts of millions of account holders in all federal credit unions and the vast majority of state chartered credit unions. During my time today, I'm going to discuss Regulation E and the requirements around opting into a financial institution service to pay an ATM or one-time debit card transaction, as well as NCUA's regulation on overdraft policies. Next slide, please. Before I begin, I'd like to take a moment and acknowledge the work that credit unions do in the financial literacy arena, particularly as it relates to overdraft. I've listed some of the ways credit unions promote financial literacy and assist their members with overdrafts here on slide 10. Under the Federal Credit Union Act, promoting financial literacy is a core credit union mission. NCUA would like to encourage credit unions to continue their work with this work, particularly as it relates to serving youth, service members and their families, older adults, those of little or modest means, and persons with language barriers. On slide 11, you'll see the regulation citation for requirements for overdraft services and the basic opt-in requirements. This part of Regulation E relates to assessing a fee or a charge on a consumer's account when the financial institution pays an ATM or one-time debit card transaction overdraft. The consumer must consent or opt in advance to this service and fee. To be clear, a financial institution can choose to pay an overdraft, but cannot impose a fee or otherwise charge the consumer unless the consumer has first opted into the service. Also, please note that my use of the term opt-out on the presentation slides refers to a consumer's decision not to consent to participate in the financial institution's service to pay ATM or one-time debit card transaction overdraft, and is not in reference to any other product type. Slide 12 provides information on the consent requirement. According to Regulation E, consumers must be provided with a written opt-in notice. However, the consumers may agree to receive it electronically. The information describing the overdraft service for the ATM or one-time debit card transaction must be separated from all the other account information. The consumer must be given a reasonable opportunity to affirmatively consent to the service. Reasonable opportunity is discussed in the commentary to the regulation and includes various standards for mail, telephone, electronic means, and in person. But the regulation is clear. The financial institution must obtain the consumer's consent to opt in. Finally, consumers must be provided with a confirmation of their consent in writing or electronically if consumers agree, and the confirmation must include a statement informing consumers of their right to revoke the consent. Next slide, please. The opt-in or consent may be part of the account opening process. The financial institution may require this as a necessary step to opening an account. Asking the consumer to check a box and sign indicating consent for the service of the payment of ATM or one-time debit card transactions under the financial institution's overdraft service. Again, the disclosure and signatures must be separated from other account information. The signature must be in addition to and separate from the one used for the signature card, and the box opting into the service cannot be pre-checked. If the consumer does not check a box or provide the signature, then the consumer has not opted in to the service. Slide 14 discusses that the financial institution meets the requirement of this part of the regulation by either mailing or delivering a copy of the consumer's opt-in notice to the consumer, or by mailing or delivering a letter or notice to the consumer that acknowledges that the consumer opted into the institution's service for ATM or one-time debit card transaction overdraft. It may be provided electronically if the consumer agrees. The confirmation must include the statement on the right to revoke, and a model notice can be found in the appendix to the regulation. The financial institution cannot assess overdraft fees until this written confirmation has been mailed or delivered to the consumer. The commentary indicates that a financial institution complies with this confirmation requirement if it has adopted reasonable procedures designed to ensure that overdraft fees are assessed only in connection with transactions paid after the confirmation is mailed or delivered to the consumer. Next slide, please. If a financial institution's internal criteria, would leave the institution to pay a check overdraft if the consumer had consented to the overdraft service for ATM and one-time debit card transactions. It must also apply the same criteria in a consistent manner in determining whether to pay the check overdraft if the consumer has not opted in. Financial institutions are not required to pay overdrafts on checks and any other types of transactions. The rule only prohibits the financial institution from considering the consumer's decision not to opt in when deciding whether to pay overdrafts. Next slide, please. As seen in slide 16, the financial institution may not vary the listed terms, conditions, or features, such as those listed on the slide provided, to a customer who does not opt in. Also, financial institutions are not prohibited from offering deposit account products with limited features, provided that a consumer is not required to open such an account because the consumer did not opt in. Next slide, please. Finally, I'd like to briefly discuss NCUA's regulation on overdraft policies. Consistent with the policies established by the credit union's board of directors, a credit application supporting the decision to make a loan or establish a line of credit is required to be kept on file for each borrower. However, if the credit union has a written overdraft policy, it may advance money to cover an account deficit without a credit application. Next slide, please. The written overdraft policy must meet certain requirements as outlined in slide 18. The policy must set a cap on the total amount of all overdrafts the credit union will honor in a manner that is consistent with the credit union's ability to absorb losses. Set a time limit for funds to be deposited or for the member to obtain an approved loan. This time limit cannot exceed 45 calendar days. Set a dollar limit on the overdrafts that will be honored per member, and set a fee and interest rate, if any, that members will be charged by the credit union for honoring overdrafts. Thank you for your time, and now I'd like to turn the presentation back over to Ducey Lay with the Federal Reserve.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. Moving to slide 19. Again, I'm Ducey Lay at the Federal Reserve. Given my role here in the UDAP enforcement section at the Federal Reserve, I'll talk about overdrafts through the UDAP lens. So just to level set, the Federal Reserve does have UDAP supervisory and enforcement authority regardless of the asset size of a state member bank. Now, with regards to overdrafts, for the banks we supervise, we do review overdraft practices. Some practices have been identified that may have been UDAP. And I note that some of these UDAP practices have arisen in connection with the use of third-party vendor software. So for this webinar, I'd like to discuss two overdraft practices that the Federal Reserve has found to be unfair or deceptive. Moving to slide 20. Now, this is the first practice that I'd like to discuss, and it's one that the Federal Reserve has found to be unfair. Specifically, we found it to be unfair when a bank assessed an overdraft fee based on the consumer's available balance at the time a transaction is posted, even though there were sufficient funds in the consumer's available balance to cover the transaction when the transaction was authorized. So that's a lot packed into that statement there, and what I can do is discuss it with an example. So let's move on to slide 21 for an example. So this is an example of how the issue arises. The chart here is organized into four columns. You'll see that the first column is for the description of the transaction. The second column is for the amount of each transaction. The third column is for the available balance, which is the ledger balance or actual balance, but taking into account any authorizations and the like. And then the last column is the ledger balance, and that's the actual money sitting in the consumer's account. So we can go through this chart day by day, transaction by transaction. So looking at day one, you see that the consumer has an opening balance of $100. The consumer goes to the grocery store, uses his debit card, and pays for $80 worth of groceries. So this transaction for $80 is authorized, and the consumer's available balance is reduced by the $80. So his available balance is now $20. So as you can see, there are sufficient funds to cover this transaction at the grocery store. Now, the next day, day two, a check the consumer wrote for $40 is posted. That reduces both his available balance and his ledger balance by $40. So now his available balance is negative $20, while his ledger balance is a positive $60. Now, since the bank uses the available balance to determine whether to assess an overdraft fee, the consumer is charged an overdraft fee for this check. And so you see that overdraft fee up there. Now, the next day, on day three, the $80 transactions for those groceries that we saw on day one is actually posted now on day three. The available balance here does not need to be reduced further since the $80 was already taken out on day one. But what we do see is the ledger balance, of course, being reduced. Now, since the available balance is already negative at this point, the $80 transaction that occurred on day one is now also charged an overdraft fee. So what this bank is doing here is using the available balance on day three to determine whether an overdraft fee is triggered for these groceries, even though the bank had deducted the transaction, the grocery store transaction, from the available balance on day one when that transaction was authorized. So because of the combination of using the available balance and the posting point in time, the consumer is assessed two overdraft fees, one for the check and one for the debit card transaction at the grocery store. So in terms of the UDAP analysis, what the Federal Reserve deemed to be unfair, is when a bank uses the available balance to assess an overdraft fee on the transaction at the time of posting, even though there were sufficient funds in the available balance at the time of authorization to cover this transaction. So that's the first overdraft practice I'm discussing today. The second overdraft practice, I promise you, is not as complicated. So let's move on to slide 22 here. Now, this second practice is one that the Federal Reserve has also found to have violated Section 5 of the FTC Act. Here, the consumer has both a deposit account and a loan with the bank. The Federal Reserve found it to be a violation of Section 5 of the FTC Act for the bank to... add the consumer's overdraft balance from his deposit account to his loan without any authorization or anything authorizing the bank to do so. So in the case we had, the bank made communications stating that the consumer owed this amount, this improperly inflated amount. And as such, we found this to be deceptive. But this practice may also be unfair. So that's the second of the two UDAP overdraft practices I plan to discuss. And with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Victoria from the CFPB.
Thanks, Juicy. So as Juicy mentioned, I'm from the Office of Supervision Policy and the Division of Supervision, Enforcement, and Fair Lending, or CEFL. And that's the largest of the Bureau's six divisions, with examiners and enforcement attorneys stationed across the country. We in CEFL supervise a range of companies to assess their compliance with federal consumer financial laws. And as I think Ducey or Kim mentioned, we have supervisory authority over banks, thrifts, and credit unions with assets over $10 billion, as well as their affiliates. We also have supervisory authority over non-bank mortgage originators and servicers, payday lenders, and private student lenders. And we supervise the larger participants of other consumer financial markets as defined by Bureau rules. So far, that includes larger participants in the consumer reporting, consumer debt collection, student loan servicing, international money transfer, and automobile financing markets. So CEFL's Office of Enforcement is one of our sister offices and enforces federal consumer financial laws by investigating cases of potential wrongdoing and taking legal action where appropriate. And of course, CEFL's Fair Lending and Equal Opportunity Office works to ensure fair, equitable, and non-discriminatory access to credit for all consumers. So as shown on slide 24, I'm going to highlight two Bureau enforcement actions that focused on overdraft violations and also supervisory concerns covered in the winter 2015 edition of the CFPB's Supervisory Highlights publication. Together, the two enforcement actions involved violations of Regulation E's overdraft opt-in requirements for ATM and one-time point-of-sale transactions, deceptive statements about overdraft fees, services, and marketing, compliance management systems and particularly monitoring weaknesses, and a failure with respect to service provider oversight, in this case, third-party telemarketers. Then I'll discuss supervisory findings involving balance calculation methods and related unfair and deceptive practices. And as a quick reminder about the Bureau's UDAP authority, so that's UDAP with two A's, which is different from but related to the FTC Act authority that a few people talked about. Under Section 1036 of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which is codified at 12 U.S.C. 5531, it's unlawful for any provider of a consumer financial product or service or a service provider to engage in any unfair, deceptive, or abusive act or practice. And then Section 1031 of the Act, which is at 12 U.S.C. 5536, provides the Bureau with enforcement authority to prevent unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices in connection with any transaction with a consumer for a consumer financial product or service or the offering of a consumer financial product or service. So moving to slide 25. In April 2015, the CFPB's Office of Enforcement acted on two distinct overdraft-related practices at Regions Bank. The first, Regions failed to obtain affirmative opt-in consent from customers consistent with Regulation E, Section 105.17. So that is before they were charged overdraft service fees for the bank to cover ATM and debit card transactions. As detailed in the consent order, the bank erroneously determined that the opt-in rule did not apply to customers with linked account coverage, such as a linked savings account or a line of credit. And as a result, Regions customers paid over $47 million in unlawfully assessed overdraft fees. The problem was magnified because Regions indicated in advertisements and information provided to consumers that it would not charge overdraft fees absent securing opt-in consent. The Bureau found these representations deceptive in violation of Sections 5531 and 5536 of the Dodd-Frank Act. And the bank delayed escalating the problem internally to senior executives and correcting the errors for almost a year. The order's findings and conclusions detail protracted efforts by compliance, legal, and other staff to implement overdraft opt-in compliance. That was first with the board's publication of a final opt-in rule in 2009. And then to identify and address regulatory noncompliance and systems errors after incorrect determinations were made about linked account coverage. And then there was a second deceptive practice that involved programming flaws that resulted in overdraft and NSF fees being charged to consumers for deposit advance product repayments. In that case, information provided to consumers in the form of FAQs indicated that Regions would not charge such fees in certain cases. But in practice, the bank charged over $1.9 million in overdraft and NSF fees. The bank's representations to the contrary were similarly found to be deceptive under the Dodd-Frank Act. So moving to slide 26. Under the consent order, the bank must ensure that it no longer charges overdraft fees without first obtaining customers' affirmative opt-in consent. Regions is prohibited from engaging in deceptive acts and practices in communications with consumers regarding overdraft and NSF fees. The bank is obligated to refund all unlawful overdraft and NSF fees charged to consumers who had not already received a refund from the bank, so over $49 million in refunds had already been paid. And it must correct negative information reported to consumer reporting agencies that resulted from the unlawful imposition of fees. And then finally, the Bureau imposed a $7.5 million civil money penalty. So moving to slide 27. In July of this past summer, the Office of Enforcement entered another order involving opt-in problems, and this time against Santander Bank. The Bureau found that Santander's telemarketing service provider enrolled certain customers in overdraft services without their consent, and as a result, the bank failed to obtain affirmative opt-in consent required by Regulation E before charging consumers overdraft fees for ATM and debit card transactions. Moving to slide 28, the Bureau found that the bank's telemarketers made false statements to customers to convince them to opt into overdraft services, and those statements were deceptive in violation of the Dodd-Frank Act. The consent order detailed a number of missteps by the service provider and the bank, including a number of particularly concerning exchanges with consumers. But in short, the bank, through its telemarketers, misled consumers about the following. Overdraft fees associated with opting in. So in a number of calls, customer service representatives stated that the overdraft service was free. The consequences of not opting in, for example, stating that consumers would be charged overdraft fees whether they opted in or not. The nature of sales calls that were sales calls, for example, stating this is not a sales call. And the types of transactions covered by the bank's overdraft service. As an example, reps told consumers that the overdraft services covered checks when it did not. The bank failed to exercise appropriate oversight. It knew that telemarketers were engaging in non-compliant behavior partway into the program, but continued to use the same vendor, include financial incentives based on enrollment volume, neglect proper monitoring, and ignore widespread problems. So moving to slide 29. Under the consent order, the bank has contacted or will contact consumers who were likely to have received misleading sales calls and give them a clear choice whether to enroll in the overdraft service. Santander will no longer use service providers to conduct outbound telemarketing for overdraft services. It will not use similarly problematic incentive schemes. And it will increase third-party telemarketer oversight by developing and implementing a new vendor management policy. And then the Bureau imposed a $10 million CMP. So then moving to slide 30. Now I'm going to turn to supervisory findings that were reported in the winter 2015 edition of Supervisory Highlights. So the Bureau publishes Supervisory Highlights a few times a year, and include key examination findings, information about recent enforcement actions that resulted at least in part from our supervisory work, and developments in the Bureau's supervision program. So in the winter 2015 edition, we explained key differences when a bank uses the ledger balance method to calculate a consumer's account balance, so that relies on only settled transactions, and the available balance, which also reflects electronic transactions that are authorized but not settled, and also deposit holds that have not yet cleared. So in some instances, examiners observed overdrafts and overdraft fees in cases where an institution relied on the available balance method to process overdrafts that would not have occurred if the institution had relied on the ledger balance method. Moving to slide 31. In order to maintain the confidentiality of supervised institutions, we don't refer to specific institutions when we discuss supervisory findings, but somewhat more specifically, when examiners reviewed overdraft protection services at multiple financial institutions, they found that one or more institutions switched from using ledger balance to available balance for the purpose of deciding whether to authorize signature-based debit and other electronic transactions and post or return checks and ACH transactions. And they switched to an available balance method to calculate whether a transaction resulted in an overdraft and or an overdraft fee was assessed when the transaction settled. So moving to slide 32, the disclosure of these changes raised deceptive practice concerns under the Dodd-Frank Act, and at one or more financial institutions, examiners found that the changes to balance calculation methods were not disclosed or were not sufficiently disclosed. As a result, customers were misled about the circumstances under which overdraft fees would be assessed, and the misleading practices were material to a reasonable consumer's decision-making and actions. And so the practices were found to be deceptive. Moving to slide 33, in addition to that, one or more institutions examiners found that institutions switched balance calculation methods and authorized an electronic transaction, which reduced a customer's available balance but did not result in an overdraft at the time of authorization. A subsequent unrelated transaction settled, further lowering the customer's available balance, and that pushed the account into overdraft. And when the original electronic transaction was later presented for settlement, so this is after the intervening transaction and overdraft fee, the original transaction also posted as an overdraft, and an additional overdraft fee was charged. Moving to slide 34. So one or more institutions were found to have engaged in both unfair and deceptive practices based on the sequence I just described. They acted unfairly because the fees caused harm to consumers. Consumers had no reason to anticipate the practice because it was not appropriately disclosed, and consumers could not reasonably avoid incurring the fees. And here, consistent with the deception findings I previously summarized, examiners found the failure to properly disclose the practice of charging overdraft fees in these circumstances to be deceptive. So moving to slide 35. It might be worth noting as we go through these practices that UDAP analyses are generally, dependent upon the facts and circumstances of a particular situation. And so examiners also found that at one or more institutions, disclosures created the misimpression that those institutions would not charge an overdraft fee for an electronic transaction if its authorization did not push the customer's available balance into overdraft status. But institutions did assess overdraft fees in a manner inconsistent with the disclosure's overall net impression. The disclosures were misleading or likely to mislead consumers and could be material to a reasonable consumer's decision-making and actions. And so the disclosures were found to be deceptive in this instance. And then moving on to my last slide, that's slide 36. The practice of assessing fees under these circumstances was also found to be unfair because consumers were or were likely to be substantially injured by overdraft fees, although the disclosures didn't give this net impression overall. Consumers could not reasonably avoid the fees, and the injury was not outweighed by countervailing benefits to consumers or to competition. So wrapping things up, when it comes to overdraft services, consumer compliance, at the Bureau, we've made notable findings with respect to overdraft opt-in rule compliance and disclosures and involving service provider oversight. And supervisory highlights covers instances where institutions needed to be more cognizant of how changes in balance calculation methods affected overdraft processing and fees, and whether the changes would result in unfair or deceptive acts or practices that harm consumers. So now I think we're going to turn things over to Artie Hollifield, who will talk about some FDIC findings. Artie?
Thank you, Victoria. Good afternoon. My name is Artie Hollifield, and I'm a senior policy analyst in the Division of Depositor and Consumer Protection at the FDIC. As a brief reminder, in addition to being the insurer for all insured depository institutions, the FDIC is also the primary federal supervisor for state chartered banks and savings associations that are not members of the Federal Reserve System. Before I begin with the specifics of my presentation, I want to remind everyone that the vast majority of FDIC supervised institutions have strong compliance programs that are highly rated. My discussion today will focus on overdraft practices that have raised some concerns at the FDIC. These practices were identified either via the FDIC's examination program or through consumer complaints. We are now on slide 38. As you can see on the slide, I will discuss the following practices. fee on fee. This occurs when a bank-assessed fee may cause an account to become negative and an overdraft fee is then assessed. Second, the ability or right to cure an overdrawn balance. This issue occurs when the availability of deposits are delayed, sometimes using regulation CC holds or sometimes caused by processing procedures. Customers may be charged continuous overdraft fees over an extended period of time, although a deposit has been made to cure the overdraft balance and to avoid additional fees. Third, calendar versus business day. This practice occurs if a bank assesses a fee based on calendar days, but a customer can only cure the overdraft on business days. In some instances, this is a case of confusing or incomplete disclosures or caused by the bank's data processing system setup. I should note, previous speakers on this call have addressed concerns regarding available versus ledger balance issues and institutions adding overdrawn balances to existing loans. We have similar concerns, though, depending on the facts and circumstances, the FDIC may reach different conclusions. Moving on to slide 39. Here is a fact pattern example of a classic fee-on-fee issue. A bank-assessed fee, for example, a monthly service fee or NSF fee, causes an account to become negative. A daily overdraft fee is then charged for the negative balance, resulting in what we have termed fee-on-fee. The account agreement and/or disclosures may mislead customers or omit material information about how and under what circumstances the daily overdraft fee is assessed. The customer is usually not clearly informed that bank-assessed fees can trigger a negative balance and the daily overdraft fee. The customers do not receive an overdraft notice when a bank fee causes a negative balance. They could not reasonably anticipate that the overdrawn balance and avoid harm from additional fees. At times, typically with an ad hoc overdraft program, a bank overdraft fee is charged for a provisional negative balance, although the bank may decide not to pay the item the next day. When the return item is credited back to the account, the bank may fail to reverse or refund the overdraft fee. The customer could end up being charged both an overdraft fee and a returned item fee. One or both of these bank fees could cause a negative balance, which could then trigger the daily overdraft fee. Again, the customer is usually not clearly informed that such bank fees can trigger a negative balance and the daily overdraft fee. Interest on fees. Recently, we have started seeing institutions assess daily overdraft interest in addition to or in lieu of a daily overdraft fee. This has raised a number of questions during compliance examinations. For example, how and where is the interest described? How and when is the interest assessed, that is, against the amount of the overdraft or the amount of the customer's negative balance, including fees and charges? Finally, if assessed against the customer's negative balance, is the daily interest assessed before or after fees are assessed? Depending on the facts and circumstances, we have cited these practices as UDAP or violations of Truth in Savings deposit account disclosure requirements. Moving on to slide number 40. I will now walk you through a scenario to provide a better understanding of what we mean by customers' rights and/or abilities to cure overdrawn balances. Generally, the availability of deposits are delayed. As noted previously, sometimes using regulation CC holds or sometimes caused by processing procedures. Customers may be charged more continuous overdraft fees over an extended period of time, although a deposit has been made to cure the overdraft balance and to avoid additional fees. First, in this scenario, the customer overdraws his or her account on Thursday. The following day, Friday, the consumer deposits a check that, if it had been credited to the customer's account immediately, would cure the overdrawn balance. The bank treats the check as received on Monday with funds available on Tuesday pursuant to Regulation CC. During the Regulation CC hold, the bank charges a daily continuous overdraft fee and per diem interest. Bankers are encouraged to review the information provided to consumers concerning overdraft services, particularly any extended overdraft and negative balance fees, and conduct transactional testing to ensure that the bank is charging these fees as disclosed. Banks should also review how these fees are assessed. The bank assesses a fee based on calendar days, but a customer can only cure the overdraft on business days. This could be an issue if the bank's disclosures indicate that the consumer has a certain number of days to cure his or her overdraft before a fee will be assessed. We will discuss this in greater detail on the next slide. Additionally, we have cited violations of Truth in Savings deposit account disclosure requirements. There may be additional regulation CC and UCC implications as well. We are now on slide 41, calendar versus business days. With this practice, we often find the concern lies with disclosures not matching how the processing system actually works. In practice, this area of concern works like this. A bank assesses a fee based on calendar days, but a customer can only cure the overdraft on business days. This could be problematic if the bank's disclosures indicate that the consumer has a certain number of days to cure his or her overdraft before a fee will be assessed. For example, if a bank charges a continuous overdraft fee after 3 days and an overdraft occurs on Thursday, the third calendar day after the overdraft is Sunday. Because Sunday is a non-processing day, if the bank charges the fee the prior Friday, this will provide the customer only 1 day to cure the overdraft, not three. Since the fee is assessed earlier than what has been disclosed to the customer, this results in a violation of Section 5 for unfair and/or deceptive practices, or a violation of the Truth in Savings disclosure requirement, depending on the specific facts and circumstances. When reviewing your overdraft payment program and transactions, consider the following. Determine whether the data processing system uses business or calendar days when calculating a fee to be assessed. Make sure the bank's method is clearly disclosed to consumers throughout all relevant disclosures and communication methods. Confirm that disclosures correctly state the number of days needed to cure an overdraft. Where disclosures provide that fees may be charged after a certain number of days, make sure the data processing system will not charge the fees on or before the indicated day. Clearly inform consumers about the bank's policies regarding continuous overdraft and negative balance fees and when and how these fees are assessed. Determine if an overdraft fee is assessed before the decision to pay or return an item. If so, and the subsequent decision is to return the item, then no overdraft has occurred. Without an overdraft, it is improper to charge an overdraft fee. The bank may be able to charge a return item fee if it was properly disclosed to the consumer, but there should not be both an overdraft fee and a return item fee. Disclose whether the assessment of bank service charges or fees can cause a daily overdraft fee to be assessed. Clearly inform consumers that bank fees can lead to a negative balance, which can lead to additional fees. Notify consumers when an overdraft occurs. It would be a best practice to remind them about the amount and timing of any continuous overdraft fee that will be assessed. Finally, after a system conversion, upgrade, or other change, test the system to make sure fees are being assessed as intended, consistent with disclosures. Collectively, we thank you for your time this afternoon. I will now turn the call back over to the moderator for the Q&A session of our call.
So just as a reminder, we'd love to hear your questions. If you could send us to the Ask Questions button in the webinar, and I believe that Ducey Lay is going to moderate those.
Great, thanks, Amy. So this is Ducey, and I can work with the other presenters here, and we'll try to answer some of the questions that are coming in. So while we're transitioning here, let me start off with a question that came in early and that I can actually answer. So one of the questions that came in early on is this webinar relevant for a bank that currently follows an ad hoc process when making overdraft decisions and does not have a formal overdraft program? So this is Ducey from the Federal Reserve, and I understand this question came in earlier on, and hope that you found this webinar to also be relevant for banks that follow an ad hoc overdraft process. If a bank is following an ad hoc process and you're engaging in the practices that were discussed today, we would hope that the bank would evaluate its practices. And regardless of whether the bank has an ad hoc process or a formal program, you'd want to assess your process or program for UDAP, for example. So, you know, one feature of a successful compliance program is that it is fairness-based and that it's focused on the potential for consumer harm. So, as I think one of the speakers mentioned, technical compliance with existing consumer protection rules is not sufficient to manage UDAP risk. So, in other words, a practice can violate UDAP or otherwise result in consumer harm, even if it does not violate any other regulatory provision. So in terms of assessing an ad hoc overdraft process or a formal program, the 2005 joint guidance on overdraft protection programs could help with that assessment. So I think we'll take that question. Let me see this other question that came in, and this is for you, Victoria, CFPB. The CFPB recently issued a final rule that regulates prepaid accounts with overdraft credit features as credit cards. Isn't the Bureau doing a rulemaking on checking account overdrafts? Can you update us on that?
Sure. So today I talked about supervising and enforcing existing laws, like such as Reg E, the opt-in rule, and Dodd-Frank's bar on unfair and deceptive acts and practices. But on a parallel track, the Bureau is continuing pre-rulemaking activities to consider potential regulation of overdraft services on checking accounts. And this work builds on the Bureau's earlier research. You might remember that in June 2013, we issued a white paper, and that summarized initial findings and highlighted a number of possible consumer protection concerns, like how consumers opt into overdraft coverage for ATM and one-time debit card transactions, overdraft coverage limits, transaction posting order practices, overdraft and insufficient funds fee structure, and involuntary account closures. And then in July 2014, we released a report providing additional information about outcomes when consumers do and do not opt into overdraft coverage for ATM and one-time debit card transactions. So the Bureau is continuing its research and its consumer testing. And as for the prepaid final rule, that was announced on October 5th, and most of that's effective on October 1st of 2017. The provisions addressing prepaid overdraft in that final rule are not intended to alter existing provisions that apply to deposit account overdraft. And the Bureau continues to study deposit account overdraft services on checking accounts and will propose any further regulatory consumer protections as appropriate through that rulemaking initiative.
Great. Thank you, Victoria. The next question we have, I believe it's for you, Artie, FDIC. And the question is, does the FDIC always review overdraft programs during compliance exams?
Thank you, Ducey. So overdraft programs are considered in all compliance examinations. I think the decision to include these programs in the scope is determined by the potential risk identified. Certain more specifics. So the FDIC examiners will determine the risk profile of an institution to establish the scope of the examination. This approach directs examiners to focus examination resources to the products, services, or markets that present the greatest potential risk of consumer harm. Over the past several years, institutions have added and or expanded the types of overdraft programs provided to customers that represent enhanced risk. Some of these programs impose substantial fees and interest and rely on third-party vendors to develop the program or the data processing systems used to implement them. Customer complaints or inquiries have increased, and it appears some of the increase may be related to customers not being fully or clearly informed about how, why, or when the overdraft fees are assessed. In some cases, overdraft fees are repeatedly charged and are disproportionate to the amount originally intended to be funded. Institutions are expected to closely monitor and oversee these overdraft programs in order to identify, manage, and mitigate the risks associated with them. Going a little further, the FDIC's risk scoping exam process evaluates the risk of consumer harm through an analysis of the institution's CMS, also the products and services offered, the market serves, and any existing or new third-party relationships. In scoping exams, FDIC examiners consider the inherent risks associated with the product and service offerings or other activities that could directly or indirectly result in consumer harm. So for example, let's say an institution introduces a new overdraft program or changes an existing one. An institution may not closely monitor audit its program disclosures or account opening practices. It may not monitor for excessive or chronic use of the overdraft program. They may not be familiar with how the data processing actually imposes the overdraft fees, provide limited training to bank staff about how to offer and explain the program to customers, and may have received several consumer inquiries or complaints about the program. So this example represents a high-risk product without effective CMS elements to mitigate that inherent risk. So therefore, a higher level of residual risk remains, and this product warrants review and transaction testing during examination. As part of the typical examination scoping process, FDIC examiners sort of focus on the areas where the risk of residual harm, of consumer harm, is elevated and not really on the areas where the risk is well controlled and the sort of residual risk of consumer harm is low.
Great. Thank you, Artie. This next question I'm going to pose to you, Lisa, it's a regulatory compliance question, which is, for joint account holders, do both parties have to opt in to the overdraft service for ATM and one-time debit card transactions, or can one account holder opt in for both parties on the account?
Thank you, Ducey. This is Lisa with the NCUA. For joint accounts, only one consumer needs to provide affirmative consent for the financial institution to treat the account as having opted in. Conversely, if one account holder on a joint account revokes the consent for the participation in the overdraft service for ATM and one-time debit card transactions, a financial institution should consider the consent revoked for that account.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. This question, I think this next question could be answered by several, but Kimberly. Kimberly, this is the question. The question is, what should a bank do when they have inappropriately been charging overdraft fees?
Thanks, Ducey. Well, first, you know, once the bank has identified the practice of inappropriately charging overdraft fees, quite frankly, it should stop the practice. Then sort of comes the hard work and the research, right? The bank should review the practice and identify the root cause. You know, how or why did the practice even start? Was it a change or a deviation from the bank's understanding of its approved practices and processes? Was it a result of software changes or issues with vendor oversight or monitoring? The bank should also determine when did the practice or change in practice, when did it begin? And what is the potential number of customers that may have been harmed? Depending on the root cause for the inappropriate charging of overdraft fees, the bank should also then update as appropriate policies, procedures, processes, conduct and update employee training, look at its third-party oversight and monitoring programs, and perhaps an increase in the audit scope or frequency. Now, if a bank believes that the issue that they've identified is a systemic issue, and that's whether it's a systemic violation of, say, some of the legal requirements under Reg E for overdraft programs, or if the practices could be seen as potentially unfair or deceptive, We highly recommend reaching out to the bank's supervisory office for guidance with a plan for corrective action, helping to make a determination if a look back is necessary and what the scope would be. Also, in any remediation plans and preparing and issuing customer notification. And this is quite frankly to ensure that any corrective action and response that the bank takes is in line with supervisory expectations.
Thank you, Kimberly. So this next question is another reg compliance question. I'm going to bounce it back to you, Lisa. It's what are the record retention requirements for opt-in notices?
Thanks, Cece. There are no specific record retention requirements for opt-in notices or the confirmation sent to consumers. However, Regulation E has a general requirement that says a financial institution has to retain evidence of compliance with the requirements imposed by the Act and regulation for a period not to be less than 2 years from the date the disclosures are required to be made or action is required to be taken.
Great. Thank you. This question I think I can take, and this is Ducey from the Federal Reserve. The question is, how do agencies view business accounts with regard to overdrafts? Are small business accounts considered a gray area? So again, this is Ducey Lay from the Federal Reserve, and for the Federal Reserve, this is not a gray area for us. The Federal Reserve's UDAP overdraft actions have included small business accounts. So we do include small business accounts in our review of overdrafts and in our review of UDAP acts or practices. Let me move on to this other question about consumer complaints. Kimberly, okay, take it. So it's talking about consumer complaints as being an early warning signal. What should a bank look for? Many of the complaints that we get involve consumers who are angry that they are getting charged a fee even though they transacted for more than within their account.
Okay. So in our experience, overdraft fees tend to generate many complaints, and we appreciate that sometimes consumers will only be letting the bank know that they're upset that a fee was charged. However, especially for written complaints, carefully considering what customers have to say can provide very valuable information. In our examination work, we've reviewed complaints to the OCC, to other regulators, and to the Better Business Bureau. And what we find that in many complaints, they indicate that consumers have signed up for online or mobile banking, are constantly checking their balances, and are very carefully ordering their transactions in order to avoid or minimize any fees that they might be charged. Yet they're surprised when they incur fees that they were not expecting based on their understanding of the bank's practices. So often these complaints contain detailed information on the customer's transactions and how the customer would have expected the transaction to be processed and covered by the funds in their own accounts. So the bank may find that there are patterns in these complaints indicating a misunderstanding or a misimpression about how the bank's account terms work in actual practice. So patterns like these may suggest that there are problems with the bank's disclosures or perhaps their marketing materials. Another example is that complaints indicating consumers were charged fees even when they did not intend to opt in to overdraft services. And a trend in these types of complaints may suggest problems in the account opening process also.
Great. Thank you, Kimberly. Victoria, I think this next question is for you. It talked about the second enforcement action that you had discussed relating to service providers, and it said that the CFPB representative talked about inadequate service provider oversight. What advice can you provide to financial institutions that want to revisit consumer compliance service provider oversight?
Well, I'll start by affirming that it can make economic sense to outsource many functions and conduct business through service providers. And that might be to minimize costs or leverage some sort of specialized experience or for other legitimate business reasons. But as a general principle, consumers should not be harmed just because institutions find it in their interest to conduct business through service providers rather than in-house, and compliance shouldn't be outsourced as well. So I guess I'll refer to the Bureau's April 2012 bulletin where we stated our expectations for our supervised institutions for overseeing service providers. We stated that we expect supervised banks and non-banks to oversee their business relationships with service providers in a manner that ensures compliance with federal consumer financial law and that is designed to protect consumer interests and avoid consumer harm. And of course, service provider oversight is a key component of an effective compliance management system and should include things like thorough due diligence, reviewing the service provider's policies, procedures, internal controls, and training, clearly stating expectations about compliance in contracts, internal controls and monitoring, and prompt corrective actions. So the structure of oversight programs are going to vary, of course, based on the size and complexity of a covered person, such as a bank's operations. But regardless of the structure, the focus should be on the effectiveness of the program. And a bank or other covered person needs to understand all relationships with service providers and the risks those providers present when it comes to consumer compliance and potential consumer harm. And infrequently used service providers can also present a significant risk of consumer harm, too. It depends on their role in providing services, interactions with consumers, and their motivation to ensure compliance. Whatever the case, policies and procedures should be sufficient to provide for effective oversight. And finally, in risk ranking service providers, so for example, if you risk them from high to low or critical to non-essential, consider the potential risk of consumer harm posed by acts or omissions of the service provider. And I'd also consider the extent to which a covered person relies on a service provider in its daily operations. The more important the service provider is to the ongoing operations of the entity, then the greater the oversight needed. So I know the other agencies have also worked on these issues. I'm not sure if anyone else wants to add anything.
Sure, this is Artie, again, with the SEIC. So I would point folks to kind of the various third-party guidances and statements that the SEIC has issued relating to third parties and sort of vendor management. Generally, I would do that. And then sort of specifically from our perspective, I think we recognize that the use of third parties can assist management in attaining their strategic objectives, increasing revenues or reducing costs. The use of a third party also commonly serves as a vehicle for management to access greater expertise or efficiency for a particular activity of their choosing. The decision about whether to use a third party should be considered by an institution's board of directors as well as senior management, taking into account the circumstances unique to the potential relationship. So, I mean, you should be aware the use of third parties in no way diminishes responsibility of the board of directors and management to ensure that the third-party activities is conducted in a safe and sound manner and in compliance with applicable laws, regulations, and internal policies. So there are going to be risks arising from an institution's use of third parties. Some of the risks may be associated with the underlying activity itself, similar to the risks faced by an institution directly conducting that activity. Other potential risks arise from or heightened by the involvement of a third party. So failure to manage these risks can expose an institution to regulatory action, financial loss, litigation, and may even impair the institution's ability to establish new or service existing customer relationships. So finally, I'll say that we expect institutions to perform the necessary due diligence when selecting a third-party provider, as well as periodically during the course of the business relationship, and particularly with a focus on when considering a renewal of a contract.
Great, thanks, Artie. So this is Ducey Lay from the Federal Reserve, and I'm just going to chime in and add on, too. What I'd like to say here is that weaknesses in third-party oversight have been cited in Federal Reserve UDAP matters related to overdrafts, as well as other products and services. So, and some of these cases have resulted in significant restitution to consumers. So that is something that is not just a third-party management issue generally, but specific to overdrafts also. And then, of course, I'd like to point you to the Federal Reserve's guidance on managing outsourcing risk. That was issued in 2013, and that's at CA letter 13-21 and SR letter 13-19. Okay. Anybody else on that? No? Okay. I think we've got some another compliance question. I think this person is talking about reg commentary. So reg commentary of the regulation provides examples of affirmative consent and an example of implementing opt-in at account opening. And this person cites commentaries 17B4 and 17B5. And the question is, could an institution provide the opt-in notice at account opening, assuming in person, and then accept a verbal consent at account opening from the consumer to opt in? Lisa, can you do us a favor and take this question?
Hi, this is Lisa from the Federal Reserve.
I'm moving.
Sorry.
not the
job.
So she's from NCUA, by the way.
Sorry, I'm from NCUA. No, the regulation is clear that verbal consent at account opening is not permissible. The disclosure and signature must be separated from other account information. The signature must be in addition to and separate from the one used for the signature card, and the box opting into the service cannot be pre-checked. In reference to the in-person, the institution provides a form for the consumer to complete and present at a branch or office to affirmatively consent to the service, is what the commentary says, and that's in reference to completing it on their own, bringing it to the, and turning it in as a branch office. In regards to opening the account, you have to have a signature. There has to be a signature on file.
Great. Thank you. So at this point, I think I'd like to thank everyone that has submitted questions. I submitted questions earlier on, as well as submitted questions today, and thank everyone for joining the webinar today. We did receive a number of questions that we did not get to, and but I do want to note that we all are taking note of the questions, all the questions that came in today. So with that, Amy, I'd like to turn this webinar back to you.
Thanks, Ducey, and thank you to all the presenters. I'm going to now, for those of you on the webinar, push out the survey link so you can take it there. You will also receive it via email, so you can take that a couple of different ways, but you do only need to take it once. We ask that you take just a minute to let us know how we're doing. We do read every response and strive to make our sessions better based upon your feedback. You can also request your CPE credit via the survey. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today, and a special thanks to all of our presenters and the Outlook Live team for their time. And as a quick reminder, remember to check out our website, consumercomplianceoutlook.org, for the archive of this call and for information on upcoming sessions. Have a great day, everyone. We'll talk to you next time.